The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's September 25th, 2024. It is also 2:40 in the afternoon, and hello. Thanks for dialing us in. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. I'm John Williams. You can hear portions of this podcast broadcast Saturday nights on WGN. Listen for me weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Chicago history website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way.
I'm Marge Halperin, drawing on a couple decades of experience as a journalist, communications consultant, government reform participant, and doing what I can to challenge authority.
I'm Eric Zorn, the once and future guest host of the Mincing Rascals. I was deposed because last week I said it was Thursday instead of Wednesday. I am also the editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a fine online newsletter that you can subscribe to by emailing me, ericzorn@gmail.com.
Yes, we'll look behind the curtain here for a second. Before we start this podcast, I always say out loud just to myself, and then I write down the date so I get it right, because I get little details like that wrong all the time. And then Pete told me when I got back from vacation, almost like, hey, I've got good news. Eric got the date wrong, and I was so happy to hear that, Eric.
I think I had the date right. I think I had the number right, but I just, you know, because we used to do this podcast on Thursdays, and in my mind echoes John Williams going, it's Thursday. So I, you know, and nobody caught it. Nobody on the panel caught it. Pete didn't catch it editing it. So it's out there for all the world to hear for all time.
So if you missed last week's podcast, go ahead and dial it in, because there's Eric's boo-boo still live and in the flesh. Well, I don't know how well Pedro Martinez is doing as the CPS CEO, but I think he must be doing a pretty good job if Mayor Brandon Johnson and the CTU want him out. Frankly, I'm a little disappointed that he isn't sticking to his guns, or my guns anyway, and promising to close some of the Chicago public schools. But Eric, I want to start with you, because you described this in a group chat as the CPS poop show, and that's not the way you put it.
Yeah, I also think described it as a cluster event of
yes,
a certain sort.
Yes, you did. We don't use those words on the Mincing Rascals.
I know. Family-friendly podcast. What's going on, for those who haven't been following us closely, is that Pedro Martinez is a holdover from Lori Lightfoot's administration. He's the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, and right now they're involved in some heavy union negotiations because the teachers' contract is up. And there's a rather substantial budget gap that the mayor and the union wants Martinez to close by taking out what amounts to a payday loan. You know, one of these, you know, we'll spend tomorrow's money today and we'll let politicians of the future worry about it. And Martinez is doing the fiscally responsible thing and saying, like, no, we can't keep paying today's bills with tomorrow's money. And the mayor has asked him to resign. He confirmed that report in the Tribune in an op-ed posted Tuesday. And so there's pressure there. Last week, the House of Delegates of the Chicago Teachers Union said that they had no confidence in Martinez. And their beef against him is that, I guess, that he's not trying hard enough to shake the money tree. It's very unclear to any of us exactly where that money is supposed to come from. They want it to come from Springfield, from the General Assembly. Their trip down there in May to try to convince lawmakers to give them more money was a failure. Stacey Davis Gates is blaming, and the union is blaming Martinez for being insufficiently enthusiastic about that. They're trying to pressure Governor Pritzker, and they're trying to pressure the General Assembly to cough up more money for them. Which would, of course, mean if they do that, they're going to have to cough up more money for a lot of the schools, school districts in the state. I don't see them getting money there. And the question becomes, well, where does this money come from? And Mayor Johnson, who said, well, he's not going to raise property taxes, and his other attempts at finding revenue have failed, has put himself into a trick bag. If he fires if he succeeds in firing Martinez or getting the Board of Education to fire him, then there's going to be, I think, some serious hell to pay for the part of voters who are going to see Johnson as more of a tool of the union than I think he would like to be seen. That's a summary. I'm sure I missed something, Austin. What did I miss in that summary?
That was really good. I would only add that over the last 2 weeks, it's been truly remarkable to see the spin cycle put on all of this by the CTU. Not only the lengths they're going to spin this, but how badly that has failed. So he's being targeted to leave office for two reasons. One, he rejected this payday loan. Now, Pedro Martinez can reject it all he wants. The board could still pass it if they wanted to. So it's not like he has power to say yes or no on the loan, but his office was saying this is a horrible idea. That's the first reason he's being targeted. The second reason is that he is a scapegoat and basically the only remaining scapegoat besides Governor Pritzker for Brandon Johnson's failure and for the union's failure to get more money from Springfield. And I think that latter piece has been under discussed because CTU leadership has put themselves in an untenable position with their own membership because they funneled millions of dollars in member dues to get Brandon Johnson elected. And remember, the promise was you're going to get this tremendous ROI on like a brand new contract that spends more than any contract ever. But the mayor cannot deliver on the overpromising that was done there because there isn't money to fund it. And given there isn't money to fund it, you need political capital to go get the money. Johnson has none of that because his first 18 months have been a disaster in a number of ways. So pushing out Pedro Martinez, I think, is as much about CTU leadership's internal politics as anything. And they need to show their members some kind of win, but it's just a show. It means nothing. Taking out Pedro Martinez does nothing for the children of Chicago, does nothing for the district's ability to get more money from Springfield. In fact, I think it makes that worse because you're going to Springfield, asking for new money, and all they're seeing is just this cluster event, we'll call it a goo-goo cluster, that's happening in the schools that doesn't inspire confidence that the state should shovel a bunch of money into what is clearly a mismanaged mess of a district.
If the union wasn't negotiating with the school system right now, would this no confidence vote have come up? Because the money is about the contract. So I'm trying to ascertain if, in fact, he's doing a good job or not. Is this all about the contract, or is it a true assessment of his ability as the CEO of the third largest school district in the country or whatever it is?
Well, the spin cycle has been from CTU, and this was to combat the point that is clear to everyone that he's being forced out because he won't take this payday loan to pay CTU contract demands. Wow. That's why he's being forced out. And so now the CTU is saying, well, he has no leg to stand on because he was the CFO of Chicago Public Schools for several years, and he did all this bad debt. Two problems with that. First, who cares what he did before? What he's doing right now is correct. So it's bad to force him out for stop. They're like, these are bad loans. Take a bad loan now, Pedro. That makes no sense.
Yeah.
And then, so first is that, that he's being, he's doing the right thing now. Second, Brandon Johnson's own CFO, Jill Jaworski, who's the CFO of the city of Chicago, she was the financial advisor on $8 billion in Chicago Public Schools borrowing over 19 deals over a 10-year period. I think this was from around 2011 to 2019, maybe 8 to 9 year period. So if you have if Pedro Martinez needs to be fired right now because of what he did as CFO, why aren't you talking about Jill Jaworski and the deals that she made for CPS? Because it's all fake. This is fake outrage being ginned up about Pedro Martinez.
In addition, I noticed that Stacey Davis Gates, in attacking Martinez for not approving that $300 million loan, I believe, they wanted to take out, which could, from some accounts, with the interest and the original $300 million cost like $1 billion over the life of the loan. One of her main things was, as you mentioned, Austin, that when he was CFO, approved such loans. So it's, according to her, hypocritical that he won't approve this one. And one of the particular quotes that I noticed from her saying was like, ask him about all those loans that he approved when he was CFO that got us into this horrible financial mess now. So she admits that those kind of loans are horrible. And yet she's saying he has to go because he won't continue doing what she herself admits is terrible.
The sad thing is that the needs of the schools and the children who go there and the people who work there are totally overshadowed by all this political game playing, talk about money. And I know, Austin, you keep saying the money isn't there, but I would like to see more of a focus on what we need the money for, because the services in the public schools are woefully inadequate. Kids, what the union's asking for is a conversation at another level about how to help children and families by using the availability of the schools and the resources of the schools if they had adequate resources. That is, this idea about stabilizing housing, having wraparound services. When my kids were in school some years ago in the public schools, there were social workers on site. They had contracts with independent services that could support the whole family, help them have stability in the community. And the schools were the center for that. The fact that they don't even have enough money to cover basic teaching needs, because schools don't all have the aides or the clerks or the assistant principals that are basic to their staffing needs, let alone talk about these kinds of services that Chicago Public Schools once offered to strengthen communities. We focus instead on this game playing, and there's just no money, so too bad. I understand why the union doesn't think that's a good answer. Why aren't we having the conversation about what's really needed to make schools functional, which always brings me to the same thing that I say on this show and everywhere else. District's too big. It's too big to succeed.
I completely get your point that we should actually be talking about what the schools need. But then the way Stacey Davis-Gates put it is, we can only talk about what we need. So they only want to talk about how much more money they need for what they want to do without getting into the really hard discussion of how do we actually restructure this whole thing so that it actually works at a level of funding that is possible. They don't really want to talk about that. Austin has many times pointed out the schools that are so under-enrolled. And I think I saw a number in maybe the Chicago Tribune editorial saying that 40% of the schools are enrolling less than half the students that the buildings are actually built for.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the thing is that closing schools is an absolutely toxic topic ever since Rahm Emanuel closed 50 schools in one fell swoop.
Well, yeah, you've got a high school with 33 students in it. And as Kate says, the talk of closing any schools is so anathema that this was part of the brief against Martinez that the union was putting forth, was that he's planning to close 100 schools. And Martinez had to come out and say, no, by God, no, I'm not going to. In fact, I'm going to do the opposite. I want to propose a further moratorium on closing schools, which, again, when you're a downstate lawmaker and you're thinking, you know, and your school system is struggling, trying to get by. And then you've got this school system in Chicago where they're saying, yeah, there's only 33 students in a school that used to have hundreds of students in it, but we're doing the best we can and we need more money. That just doesn't sell. And it's a problem that you talk about, you know, schools as community centers and all that, but at some point, you're going to have to make the decision like we're going to look like we're tightening our belts.
So why is he backing away from that, Eric? Why he said until his I'm wondering why he's backing away from that. He said until his contract expires, they will have a moratorium on this.
It's orthodoxy right now. It's orthodoxy among people in Chicago. I think it's progressive orthodoxy. And again, I understand that schools are anchors for communities. And I understand that teachers need more money and they need more resources and they need librarians and nurses and all this. That's all true. But at some point, you have to look like you're serious about making good use of your resources. I saw some figure that this high school with the 33 students in it, the cost per student per year is somewhere around $68,000 per student.
This is Douglas High School on the west side. There's 35 students and 32 full-time staff. And that's the same ideology that says we can't close schools. So these are anchors of the community, that we need to shove a bunch of money into empty buildings because somehow that is equitable. And it's crazy. And it shouldn't be the orthodoxy that it's a third rail to talk about school consolidations and closures. And I think that's it's actually not reflective of what voters want. I think many voters are totally on board with saying, hey, a third of the schools are half empty. Maybe there's some money we could make by doing other things with school buildings. And remember, Rahm Emanuel won re-election after doing that. He won. He beat Chuy Garcia by 10 points. So I don't think it's as much of a third rail as people think it is. Pedro Martinez knows it's a third rail right now, because if he says, I'm going to close schools, the entire Black caucus in the city council is going to go against him. So and he needs all the help he can get right now. He's fighting for his life. And I just one point on the money, and this is a case where it's like they're pointing a finger at Pedro and there's four fingers pointing back at the CTU. Throughout the spring of this year, Brandon Johnson could have asked J.B. Pritzker for $1 billion. He never did. CTU was down in Springfield asking for money with Pedro Martinez. Where did they choose to spend their political capital? It wasn't on getting a new $1 billion. It was on stopping the school board from being fully elected. They wanted a hybrid so that they didn't have to spend all this money on races this November. So they spent a ton of political capital on that. And they spent a ton of political capital to defeat a bill that would have stopped, guess what, school closures. So it's fake outrage to try to do a power play for their own membership. It has nothing to do with kids. It has nothing to do with the viability of Chicago public schools. It's purely a power play.
And they want $1 billion for a new Bears stadium on the lakefront. But let me go back, because there's something you just said that I think was a little cavalier, Austin. This idea that voters are fine closing schools, I don't think this is like a popular vote. You're not closing a school in my neighborhood, so sure, I'm fine with it. That's not the question that we put to voters. And I think communities have to be involved in the decisions to close schools. The problem with what Rahm did is it was clumsy at best. It was ham-handed. He just shut them all down without a plan for the schools. So communities were bereft and angry, rightfully so. What are you going to do with this community anchor? It takes a much more thoughtful, detailed plan to close a school in the middle of a community. What are you going to do with it? Where are the kids going to go? That idea that you escorted them, they had a fancy name for the safety patrol that would take them across gang lines. They didn't have a solid plan for keeping kids safe or for improving education at the schools that they ended up at. It was just a mess. So, yeah, it's a toxic idea now, because that's the picture people have as to how it could be done. Is there a more thoughtful, supportive way to help build communities instead of tearing them further down?
Yeah, my argument would be, despite the clumsy and horrific way in which that was carried out, which was, I totally agree, ham-handed, he still won re-election pretty handily. And that doesn't mean that what he did was good. I just think it means that any talk of school closures being bad, I think that's an incorrect orthodoxy. And I also would like to note that it's a false choice between tax hikes and close a bunch of schools. I mean, there are tons of things CPS could be doing to save money. One, for example, if they just returned to the staffing levels of 2019, just 2019 staffing levels, that saves $500 to $700 million out of a $1 billion budget deficit. That's just going back to what we had in 2019.
Is that administrative staff or school?
Both, but the administrative is the larger chunk. The amount of hiring that happened in Chicago public schools while federal relief money was pouring in was ridiculous, which is why I should say, like, Pedro Martinez should not be fired because the CTU wants him to be fired. It also was irresponsible of him to hire a bunch of people during COVID, but CTU was pushing that very hard too. They wanted to use all that money for operational spending because they knew this day would come where the money runs out, and now it's really politically difficult to cut. that was endorsed fully by the union in public openly.
Well, if you consolidated some of the schools, if it's a staffing issue in the classroom or administratively, wouldn't you have more people to fill the positions that the schools currently don't have filled?
Absolutely. You could also rent. So right now, if you're a charter school or private school, you're not allowed to rent Chicago Public Schools building space. So simply allowing those to be rented for schools that are already serving kids, that's already revenue that would be coming into CPS. And that's just not on the table.
All this argument about Johnson trying to push out Pedro Martinez and this silly loan also just takes all the focus off of the new five-year strategic plan that the board just passed. I mean, is Pedro Martinez and the board, is their plan necessarily the most wonderful plan ever? Is he necessarily the most wonderful CPS CEO ever? You know, not necessarily. I mean, it's very complicated. I'm not sure what side I really would come down on, but the fact is the board has taken a fairly controversial stand among many people about deciding to change the funding formula. So that instead of following students and the number of students enrolled in a school, that it will be equitable funding, as they say, so that every school will get a certain bottom level of teachers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they've been, and regardless of how small the enrollment is, and they've been very weaselly about how this is really in the long term going to affect school choice, which CTU is clearly against. So very weaselly about how it's ultimately going to affect the selective enrollment schools, the magnet schools, et cetera. But all the discussion of whether this plan is in fact terrific is pretty much off the table because we're all just talking about this loan and Pedro Martinez.
He does in the editorial in the Tribune today defend CPS. Of course he does. He said, do the metrics. We have more than 5,600 additional positions and nearly 2,000 additional teachers since I joined CPS. So there he's arguing that he's at least accommodating the demands by the union. What are you talking about? We've got 7,000 more employees. He said we've doubled down on core instruction, ranking first in reading growth and third in combined reading and math growth in 2023 among large urban districts. Our 2024 state assessment reports show how continued gains and our graduation rates continue to climb. The CPS class of 2024 graduates earned a record-breaking $2 billion in college scholarships. I don't know. That all sounds pretty good to me. I don't know if that makes him a good... It seems to me like everybody says, the kids can't read. They can't do math at level. I guess that can be true also.
The improvements, I just couldn't help but think as I heard you read that about what Austin just said. I think there has to be a relationship between increased staffing at the school level and better results for the kids. And I feel like he does get some credit for that if he knew where to direct the money that he had and as he managed the system, students are performing better. I'm not sure he's as good as he needs to be at playing politics, however. and that has been the downfall of many a fine school's CEO, right? We've seen one after another fall for not playing the game the way they needed to. And he's in some hot water today. There's a last minute, like just as we went to record this show, word that the board president is objecting to the statement that Martinez put out saying, as a joint statement, we, CPS and the board, promised the further moratorium on school closings. We also have no plans to discuss at the current meeting that's happening on Thursday of this week to discuss Martinez's contract or the short-term loan. And board president is just as we started recordings announced, wait, I didn't know anything about that. I'm not a part of that statement. And so they're retracting it now, calling it a CPS statement, not a CPS and board statement, and leaving us in the dark as to what the board really thinks, which is also a problem, I believe. Instead of just saying, wait, that statement didn't come from me, I'd like to hear board members tell us what they think. And what are they doing? They're just sort of like moving their chips around on the board back and forth until they're told by somebody what they need to do, or until they get the spine to further advance what they've been doing, which is the right thing so far, to refuse the loan. And we're all mired in this political back and forth. Frankly, whichever direction they go, I don't think they're improving education for students.
And that generated a very interesting response on the fake outrage point. So Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who was formerly the mayor's floor leader, had to step down because he was physically confrontational with an alderman.
And you need to put quotes around that, but keep going.
Yeah, quote unquote. He used physical intimidation. And he's saying this is a fireable offense. And that's a very important term.
What are you talking about? What's the fireable offense?
Putting out that
statement. That Pedro in some way collaborated with the board to mm-hmm. issue some kind of statement in the board's name that the board didn't actually approve
Got
of.
Got it. Yeah.
So Carlos Ramirez Rosa says this is a fireable offense. And this is the game. And this is what they're doing. They're throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall to see if it will stick to Pedro Martinez, for this very simple reason. If they fire him for cause, if they fire him without cause, then he gets 6 months severance at least, right? And there could be more in that contract. We actually don't know what the contract says. It's been reported that he gets at least 6 months of severance, and actually 6 months notice. He probably gets more severance, 6 months notice. He'd still be on the job for six more months. That's for firing without cause. Firing with cause, they have to come up with a cause, because then that's going to be a legal battle. And there's going to be a lot of discovery in that legal battle in terms of how CTU is involved with the board and what the board said. So this is all sort of a PR offensive to say we have cause to fire Pedro Martinez. And every single reason they've given has been bunk.
Well, they're talking also about, aren't they talking about insubordination? Like, the key is supposed to answer to the mayor, and the mayor wants him to take out this loan, and he's not approved it.
Right.
But if they fire Martinez for putting out a memo that suggests that everybody was on board with it, and it wasn't, and they call that cause to fire someone from a job like that, I think that the public would be really upset about that. That seems so transparent and
such
and
a low
so,
bar too.
It's such a low bar, and I mean, I think you combine all these things, all these various missteps that Johnson has made lately, going out in favor of the stadium that nobody seems to want, and the shot spotter thing, which, like Greg Hines reported, it's on a poll that shows 70% of the public is not on board with ending shot spotter, and it just seems like he is stepping on rakes over and over again, and he thinks he's going to serve more years in office than Richie Daley did. It's kind of nuts right now, and this whole thing is it seems like it's out of control, I think that what we need to see is the union and city hall and the board pulling on this, and the legislature and the governor all pulling on the same oars that Marge talks about. You're like, well, what are we going to do for the kids in the schools of Chicago? What do they need, and how can we get that funded? Rather than this finger pointing and this ridiculous complaints about a memo that doesn't have all the right names on it. This is a big political story as well as an education story.
And what do you make of that exactly, Eric? Because I already said I didn't think Martinez was the best at playing politics, but he's not that clumsy that he would put out a statement attributing it to the board when he hadn't gotten the board's okay on it. Who gave him the okay for that? And gave the president clearance. We've seen these games. I've seen them from the inside and the outside. I know how they're done. Somebody told him to go ahead with it and gave the board president plausible deniability so they could say, this is the first I've seen of it. But he didn't do it without any okay from the board. Did they have an intermediary who misspoke, or they're trying to catch him inside? There is a backstory, and I hope somebody who is covering the Board of Ed and has the sources to tell us what really happened will tell us, because I think somebody led him down a path, let's say, and then pulled the rug out from under him, or whatever analogy you want to use. And I'd like to know how that happened, because I don't think he's that bad at it.
My best guess is that that was a communication probably between someone in Martinez's staff and someone like the chief of staff of the Chicago Public Schools.
Yep.
To Eric's point, though, if I wrote this yesterday on X, formerly known as Twitter, but if publishing a poorly thought out press release was a fireable offense, Brandon Johnson would have lasted 1 week in office. And that is, if you guys remember the first thing in his administration, I was just reminded of this yesterday, when they blamed the ShotSpotter extension on like auto pay features. And that was like a big, big story.
Yeah.
There's been so many of these problems with press releases from the mayor's office. So for them to be like, that's a fireable offense, Pedro Martinez, that's the last straw, is ludicrous.
One thing I just have to throw in too, it goes a little bit farther back to when you were reading from the editorial, John, about the 80% graduation rate and the improved reading and math. I mean, we all know you can increase your graduation rate if you're willing to graduate people no matter what their testing is. And I know that the reading and math scores have improved a little bit the last couple of years, but we also all know it's still abysmal. So I looked it up while we were just now talking. Yeah, it's improved by a couple of percentage points, but it's still only 31% of elementary school students in CPS are proficient in reading and only 19% in math. So it's just not something to be bragging about.
No, it's not. But, you know, this came up on a previous podcast over a year ago, I would guess. Austin reminded us, and I think I'm remembering this correctly, Austin, that as bad as CPS performs, the whole state has a problem. When I looked it back up again in the last year, if you go to Decatur or Rockford or Springfield, the numbers are not only bad, some of them are considerably worse than CPS. Mm-hmm. That's not bragging, but it's evidently not just unique to the Chicago Public Schools.
I'll tell you what I found very disturbing was that last week, after they passed the new plan, Martinez specifically said that they were no longer going to be assessing schools in terms of student performance, that it's not enough to look at student testing. That's not important. I actually had to cut and paste it. So if we talked about this, that I'd be able to say what he said. Like measuring not just academic progress, but student well-being and connection to the extent that they're an empowered decision maker, whether or not they're prepared and making sure they're prepared for post-secondary success. This is what they're going to measure somehow instead of using actual test scores. So what it sounds like to me is, let's not actually see how well the students are doing.
Well, does it say instead of? You just said not just by. Those measurements don't sound bad to me. They're about the viability of the education kids are receiving.
He says the new approach will be to define student success more holistically. So it may be some small measure, but they're going to put a whole bunch of other stuff in there too to camouflage it.
Or to supplement it, depends on how you look at it.
Well, we'll see.
Two words, camouflage.
The fact is, they don't like the fact, he specifically said so, that families were trying to choose schools according to how well the students there were doing. That, as they, in their view, that pits schools against each other, as opposed to from the viewpoint of a parent, it tells you, oh, that school is doing something right. My child might do well at that school. I will try to send my student there. They would rather the parents not be able to see so easily where they're doing a good job education-wise. And I just don't think that's right.
Well, infamously, I believe this was maybe 2 months ago, Stacey Davis Gates went on WVON and said that testing was a tool of white supremacy. And many black callers called in saying, yeah, testing might not be perfect, but I needed to pass standardized tests, and I would very much like my kids to be able to pass standardized tests.
Right.
And you're right, John, that CPS is not so much of an outlier in terms of poor education outcomes, and definitely the delta in terms of the gains that's been reported since COVID have been better than other large school districts, which is a low bar. But it is an outlier substantially on the state of its finances. and the fact that it's spent way, way, way more than it's taken in. It is the by far largest junk bond school district and largest junk bond local government entity in the country. So the fact that they're talking about getting loans in the door that are with these ridiculous payment terms is crazy, given that outlier status.
Stacey Davis Gates wants $1 billion more from the state of Illinois this year. And the number I saw is that currently CPS is spending $800 million a year, which is pretty close to a billion, on its debts, paying off debts.
And it's a $10 billion budget. Is that the budget for the school year, $10 billion?
Roughly. You know, Stacey Davis Gates, when she's asked about where the money's supposed to come from on Chicago Tonight on Monday, Brandis Friedman asked her, like, where's this money going to come from? You want all these demands. She then told a story about an African-American mother who got an extra job, took a second job in order to get her child to school in a new car. And so that was her answer, like, basically, get a job, figure it out and get a job. And it just like made no sense. And I realize that it's not Stacey Davis Gates' job to find the revenue, but I think it is politically her job to make everybody in town feel like that the teachers and the taxpayers are on the same side, that we all want the same thing, that she needs to collaborate with the governor and the mayor, obviously, who was an ally, and the legislators to make them all feel like we have common cause here. And statements like that do not send that message. And I don't know, maybe it has worked for the teachers union before, they're so powerful, but as a resident of Chicago, I feel really put off by her just sort of saying like, well, this is not my job. I want, but I don't care where the money, it's not my job to figure out where the money comes from. That just seems very tone deaf to me.
Yeah, but it is your job to appreciate that there is a deficit. I mean, I agree. It's not her job to find the money. Somebody needs to go to bat for the schools and she's not that person. But she shouldn't be willfully ignorant about it, and that's what it sounds like.
I wish she would call for the kind of coalition that it would take to get the money the schools need. I don't know that there's a big disagreement, except Austin has some ideas about where to spend the money, but I don't think there's a big disagreement that they need more money, and they've been underfunded traditionally going back, I don't know how, you know, decades, all of our lifetime. So if instead of saying, I don't care where the money comes from, it's not up to me, why doesn't she call for a serious conversation about what is needed to adequately serve our communities and our children and where we're going to get those resources? Because clearly they're not here, but that isn't going to make, if I were the CTU, I would say that's not going to make me pare down my demands, because I can see what the schools need. We got to talk about how we're going to deliver it. And in the past, coalitions of, you know, Jackie Vaughn used to go down to Springfield with the mayor and they would make the case together. I just, that's not happening now. Of course, the mayor doesn't have a relationship with the governor that'll get us very far. It's also fractured.
Part of that reason is that Mayor Johnson is seen as a tool of the teachers union. They funded his campaign. He used to work for them. So it's not like, well, here we are, the mayor and the school board and the union leader going down together, hand in hand. Well, of course they're hand in hand. That's part of the issue that I think that the failure to see around the corner by the union was like, this is not going to be easy for us to negotiate a contract with a city that doesn't have much money when usually the mayor is our enemy. Mayor Lightfoot was the enemy last time when they went on strike. She was the one who was being fleeing. They can't make Brandon Johnson the mayor, the enemy. So now they've got to make Pedro Martinez the enemy. And it doesn't seem to be selling to me, but I guess we'll see where it ends up.
There's a few other things we want to get to, but give me half a minute to remind you that Ottawa, Illinois, is the middle of everywhere. Surrounded by open spaces, rivers, and trails, Ottawa is a natural setting that allows you to get outdoors and enjoy some fall relaxation. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms. Everything from established hotels to luxury resorts, private rentals, B&Bs. Plan your fall trip today at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Now, back to the Mincing Rascals. J.D. Power and Associates rated the airports in the country, and they said that of the mega airports, Minneapolis-St. Paul is the best airport in the United States. On a scale of 1 to 1,000, they scored 671 points. Detroit, Phoenix, and JFK are the big four best airports. Minneapolis, Detroit, Phoenix, and JFK. The average score is 595 points on a scale of 1 to 1,000. O'Hare is in the bottom half. Quite a bit so. In fact, only Toronto and Newark scored worse than O'Hare among the largest airports in the USA, scoring 469 points compared to 671 or the national average of 595. Midway does about the same. They're in the bottom few, well below the average. John Wayne in Orange County is number one. Tampa and Kansas City are the top three midsize, or what they call large airports. Midway is below the national average, along with Honolulu, St. Louis, Montreal, and Philadelphia International. I don't care too much about these ratings. It gets a lot of press. It, you know, to me, I go to an airport, and I walk through that mall that you have to go through now, and then I get on an airplane. And the only way I would score an airport is, did the plane take off and land safely within about 10 minutes of the scheduled time? I would like to get my bag quickly. I mean, there are things that matter, but I'm not going to change my travel plans as a result of O'Hare or Midway getting below average ratings.
Yeah, what were the metrics on this? What were they? Were they counting Prada stores, or were they doing like the speed of baggage delivery or cleanliness or
all of those things, Eric?
Ease of parking.
Yes,
I have the same feeling that you do about airports, which is, you know, if I can get to the airport, I think that the L access, the Blue Line access to O'Hare is very handy. Works really well for me. I live a couple blocks from the Blue Line. It is really good, and the airport seems clean enough to me. And there's enough in the way of food there in case I'm early. And security seems to be moving pretty well these days. I'm not sure what I would want more out of an airport than I'm getting at O'Hare. I haven't flown out of Midway in a while.
We travel internationally every year, and I will say this. There's some airports that are spectacular that you go, oh, my God, this is so cool. They're beautiful, and the dining and drinking options are really pleasant. And it's so I could see how they would be better, but I just don't feel like I'm necessarily slighted. I'll get a drink somewhere if I want, and I just want the airplane to take off on time.
Well, O'Hare has one redeeming quality, which is the best airport food in the country, in my opinion, which is the Rick Bayless Frontera. It's extraordinary.
It is good.
I would put it against any other food establishment in any other American airport.
Wowzers.
Everything else below average. It's not clean. And my biggest beef is there's no outlets. People are sitting around. You need outlets. That's a bit like number one airport thing to have. And it's an old airport, so everybody wasn't carrying around mobile devices.
That that's interesting. Yeah, right. I see what you're saying.
That's a big problem with O'Hare.
Really good point. Really good point.
It bothers me that in the baggage carousel area, they don't have a lot of restrooms. You know, you've been on a flight for however many hours. You've been drinking coffee, water, soda, whatever you're drinking on the plane. And then you land and you got to stand there. And it's like, oh, man, having just recently had a long flight, I can tell you that was an issue.
To answer the question, Eric, that you asked about the criteria, when you look at their announcement, J.D. Power says a lot of it is the fact that O'Hare and Midway are kind of outdated. They're being redesigned in the future. Midway's underway, but not complete, and the terminal redesign, I think, is accelerating next year, although the food offerings are a lot better at Midway than they used to be. Big and Littles is almost as good as Rick Bayless. They had some pretty good tacos at Midway, where I tend to go mostly. I have the opposite from you, Eric. I can get to Midway. I can step off an airplane, pick up my bag, and be in my front door in 45 minutes.
Nice.
O'Hare, I can't even be at O'Hare in 45 minutes.
How did LaGuardia rate? In New York City, the new LaGuardia there, they have dedicated security area, and that worked really, really well. And, of course, the security screenings at O'Hare are kind of shoehorned into old spaces where they just had to, like, squeeze a spot there, didn't put anything else in there, so that the lines snake everywhere, and it's kind of confusing. I thought that LaGuardia was a terrific airport, but compared to O'Hare.
Well, when we, and I'll just say this, too, because we just flew back from England. get global entry. If you do not have global entry, when we got off the airplane, the Disneyland-ish snake line of people waiting to get through customs was fantastically long. And those global entry people just walked right by, I'll bet 1,000 people. It was insane. You know, we had our bags and we're out the door before some people had cleared customs yet. I don't know what that's all about. Hiring, I guess, staffing, or maybe logistics. Where do you shuttle the people to and get them all through a queue? But it's global entry is this little plastic card you put in your wallet, and boy, does that save you a lot of heartache.
You don't even need the card if you know the number.
Oh, really? Is that true?
I think that's true.
Wow.
The new LaGuardia is gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's got some good food places. The bathrooms are gigantic and so clean.
Fountain? There's that cool fountain thing?
Yeah, the cool fountain thing. But you know what I would say about it is, when I think about it compared to Midway, because I fly, New York is like the main place I go. So, and I'm always going Midway, LaGuardia, LaGuardia, Midway. And the thing about LaGuardia, though, it occurs to me compared to Midway is, Midway is a really fairly quick trot from your arrival to where you want to go to.
Yeah.
LaGuardia, as much as I do like the new LaGuardia, it's a real hike. My only complaint about Midway would be, you literally cannot get a decent breakfast at Midway. You can't even get a decent bagel at Midway. Even if you are willing to stand in like a half a block long line at the Einstein Bagels, the ones at Midway are terrible. Like, I went to the Big Shoulders Coffee last time I was there when I forgot to bring my own bagel for breakfast. And the thing that they gave me, the idea that they called it a bagel was insane, just nuts. So then I actually dumped it and went back to Einstein Bagels and stood in line.
Austin, you got to go. Speaking of transportation.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for your input today, Mr. Berg.
You're welcome.
It's good.
Austin won't be able to hear us talk about the performance of the White Sox in these last two critical weeks. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about the presidential election. Let's talk about the White Sox, and then we'll go on to the election. Eric, you have been prescient, I would almost say, in April of this year, before anybody knew really how historically bad the White Sox were going to be. We knew they wouldn't be good, but starting in April, you made up a sort of all-time worst baseball division, right?
Yeah, I had the four worst teams in modern baseball history pitted against each other at that point in the season. So after a certain number of games, I would look at what the standings would be between those four teams. And the White Sox were not always worse, but they were, you know, somewhere in the middle there. They's usually the 1916 Philadelphia Athletics were leading the way because they were just really terrible. But the White Sox, unless they win two more games in their final five games, they are going to be, if they only win one, they're going to be the worst team in baseball history. I think that's right. So I've been watching that. I mean, it's interesting because
they've tied the modern day record with the Mets as of this recording.
As of this recording, and you went to the game last night thinking you were going to watch them break the record.
Yeah, I was there,
and they disappointed again.
I want to say this, that when the Angels did something well, the crowd cheered. And when the White Sox did something bad, the crowd cheered. That, what was it, 17,000 people that were there for the 17,600 for the White Sox. Southsiders, Northsiders, it was a Chicago, when a lot of Angel fans there, when a lot of Cub fans there. It was a White Sox crowd. And anytime something went badly for the White Sox, the crowd cheered. And then they chanted, sell the team, sell the team. When the Angels went up with a home run, the crowd was elated. They were all, they said, it's happening, yes. It was like, you know, it was this historic moment. We bought the right ticket. And, of course, then it just turns out for the first time this season, the Sox came from behind to win a game. But it was a cynical, jubilant, weird crowd.
I'm not surprised. I heard, or actually I saw a video of people who were booing when the White Sox won the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the end of the game, they were booing because
tell what
they
we paid for. I want to read. I want my money back.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, I mean, it's made it interesting, and you know, yeah, I guess you got to feel bad for the players a little bit, although they are well compensated for playing a game. But it must be tough to be to know that you're going to be on the worst team in baseball history. But it's just been interesting to watch. I mean, much more interesting in some ways than the Cubs, who have just been kind of mediocre all year, and they're out of playoff contention yet again. And they're just kind of like, oh, well, yeah, the Cubs been kind of mediocre. But the White Sox are spectacularly bad, and it's interesting to watch.
It's a defense mechanism, guys. Sox fans are just used to this. They've got to deal with it psychologically in some way, so don't judge them too much. Also, you know, the hatred of Jerry Reinsdorf is just so dear to a Sox fan's heart. It's like the one thing I think that we all have in common, no matter how diverse the Sox fandom is.
Sam Anderson, who does sports reporting for the New York Times, Sunday Magazine and the New York Times, and wrote just a great book called Boomtown about Oklahoma City, the Oklahoma City Thunder, and it's kind of a biography of that town told through a bunch of lenses. Anyway, so the New York Times has sent him out to Chicago. He's been following the team. He's gone to the last 18 games writing and reporting about this historic American event. And I asked him today if he has ever seen a fan base dislike their owner as much as White Sox fans dislike Jerry Reinsdorf. And he said, I'd never seen anything like it.
See, we have that going for us.
So meanwhile, I have to ask, because, you know, my lens is always about what they're asking the taxpayers for. Why was last week the opportunity that they chose to invite lawmakers to come to this new ball diamond that the Sox built for a cost of nearly $1 million, they said, down in the 78, where they are hoping taxpayers will fund a new stadium? So now they think, great, we're about to set this spectacular record. Maybe they're focusing on that word as opposed to the record itself. So let's invite state lawmakers down to see if they'll give us some money for a new stadium. Doesn't that seem like spectacularly bad timing?
Yeah. Well, there's no good timing for them right now. But what did they build then or do or invite the lawmakers to?
So they built a diamond. They built a regulation diamond down on the 78, which is closed off to the public. Somebody just told me they jumped a fence and hung out there.
It's a block for development, yeah.
That's right. It's the development site where the Sox would like to put a new stadium that is funded by us, the taxpayers. And they haven't gotten a lot of traction. So they built this diamond kind of stealthily. If you walk by, you could see it. I've seen it. You look down from Roosevelt Road, and you can see it down below at Wells. But they didn't announce anything. But they did send out an invitation to state lawmakers. And the wording of it, I wish I still had it in front of me, but it was like, come shag a few balls on a regulation diamond and stand where the future Sox pitchers will stand and all that. You know, bring your family.
So it's got a lawn and bases and everything. It's not a stadium, but the field.
But the field is
350 feet down the line. Wow.
Yeah. So they didn't allow media, but they invited lawmakers, and they aren't telling us who took them up on the invitation.
Doesn't that sound kind of brilliant, though? Because it's so hard to envision it. Well, here they mowed it right in.
That's right.
Except the timing is not good, but were the timing good? You're the public relations expert here. Doesn't that sound kind of clever to you?
Oh, yeah, it was smart. And the fact that they kept it under wraps till it had happened, basically, was also very well executed. Then they started inviting a few reporters to come, but not at the same time as the lawmakers who were there. So we don't know what their experience was or what their feelings are.
I think Speaker Welch, Chris Welch, said that he enjoyed it, but he still was very dubious about the funding. You know, it'd be good timing if the White Sox were having a good season or maybe in playoff contention, and if the Bears weren't asking for a similar, if not larger, handout to build a stadium on the lakefront. I mean, I think that the combination of those two, plus the getting back to our earlier subject, plus the schools going down to spring, everyone's going down to Springfield with their hat in their hand, or their tin, shaking their tin cup at the legislators, is just not going to work. I don't see the White Sox getting their new stadium there, even though it does seem like it could be a beautiful spot for it. And you kind of wish. I mean, they built New Comiskey or whatever it's called now, Guaranteed Rate. They built that field in the early 90s. I mean, it's not that old. And for them all of a sudden to say, well, it's outmoded now. And, you know, it's like, come on, it was a bad ballpark when you built it. They had to reconfigure it pretty quickly because people were complaining about it. And so it's like, I just can't feel for them. It's a pretty nice stadium with their night now. I don't quite understand. It's like, not like it's falling apart. Old Comiskey was falling apart. That place was a dump. And I got that they needed a new stadium, but this one's only been around since the early 90s. It's crazy.
Marge, while I was gone, I read the letter to the editor, or was it an op-ed piece that you had in the paper about how you'd wish we would stop laughing about Donald Trump's suggesting that in Springfield, Ohio, they are eating the pets, the Haitian immigrants are. Did you get much of a reaction from that? And has your opinion changed about that? It does seem like that story is starting to fade in our rearview mirrors.
Well, I got the worst threatening troll response I've ever gotten to anything I've
really?
Ever printed.
Yeah.
Guy basically, you know, said, well, you probably want to kill babies too, don't you? I don't know. It was a mess. But other than that, most of the response I got was positive. And yeah, I feel like that story, in a way, it's fading, and in a way, it's not. They're still pumping it out to the base. And when I saw, my reaction was, you know, visceral to the whole thing. When I saw Trump in the debate, they're eating the pets. You know, he was screaming. He was obviously out of control. But then you hear Vance, J.D. Vance, as we talked about last week, I think, you know, say, well, sometimes you just got to make up the story in order to get the create the story was his word, in order to get the media to cover it. And he achieved his goal in that he's getting people to other yet another group of immigrants and make people afraid. You know, I'm starting to think you could paraphrase the old line, you know, first they came for the Mexicans and Venezuelans, then they came for the Jews, then they came for Black Haitian immigrants. You know, they're ticking off these groups, and the ones who are celebrating are the neo-Nazi groups, the Blood Tribe, is that what they're called? I just forget their name. Who pushed this whole thing about the Haitian immigrants and pets in August. They're cheering. I heard a story about them just, you know, thumping their chests at how great that their story made it out with such a high profile. So then I look at my social media feed and people are laughing about dogs driving away from Springfield. There's nothing funny about it. And the more we spread the so-called humorous memes in our blue bubble, the more we're actually spreading the evil story.
These are terrible stories. And what they're saying is terrible. The fact that they're cheering this idea of mass deportations is frightening. You say, who are they going to come from next? Trump the other day said that people who criticize the U.S. Supreme Court should be jailed. This guy is out of control. He is a budding fascist, if not a complete fascist already. And I don't know how the media can treat this, because every day he says things that are extremely alarming. And the idea that this whole story in Springfield, Ohio is bogus, that these Haitian immigrants were brought there because there were jobs that needed to be done. They're doing the jobs. They've improved that community greatly. There's been no murders at all. According to the county prosecutor, there have been no murders at all related to the Haitian immigrant population. And so for Vance and Trump to carry on about how murders have gone up, which they have not, and how infectious diseases have gone up, which they have not. I mean, these are all based on terrible nativist lies. And it just boggles my mind that so many people say, well, yes, but Trump had a better economy than Biden, which again is not, I think, not particularly true.
Not even true.
And I don't understand how people are sticking with him. I understand that fringe people stick with him because they, you know, they hate the same people he hates. But there are so many people who I know who are Republicans, who are decent people, who really want the best for this country, who are yet embracing this awful man. I mean, I think he may be the worst person ever to run for high office in this country. I mean, there have been some really terrible people. He may well be the worst. I'm getting off my soapbox now.
For what it's worth, though, the whole crazy, completely fake, made up story about Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, has, unless I've missed something, really backfired on them. The Trump campaign has really stalled out. Obviously, Kamala Harris has more than made up the Biden gap and went far beyond him. She has plateaued a little bit. But the fact is, he has been shooting himself in the foot over and over again. Oh, maybe that's not the metaphor I should have used. Ever since his first assassination attempt, he has just really done everything wrong. And this is just one of those examples. So he could be really bringing hard points across that she doesn't really want to talk about. Like, why has she changed her mind about immigration? Why has she changed her mind about decriminalizing illegal border crossings, for instance? And instead, they're making up these silly stories. So as annoying and awful as it is, as long as he keeps doing things like this, that is the best thing that can happen for Kamala Harris.
I was saying, I wish I could agree, but the two issues that Trump has to run on are the economy and fear of immigrants. So backfired in a way because it was proven to be not true, but doesn't stop people from circulating the story or from being reminding people about, you know, they're sending us their worst people pouring across the borders, open borders. All those phrases are reinforced by that story in a narrow group of voters that we are trying to convince otherwise. You know, it's a small number of people who will decide. Yeah, yeah. It's not his base or ours. But fear of immigration and concern, lack of confidence about the economy are the two things that can get him elected. And he's finding lots of ways to address those issues. I think this is one more of those ways. And while it's not true, I mean, I had somebody send me a clip supposedly of a guy testifying in Springfield, Ohio, about, you know, he has seen this happen. And then I went back to click on it, and it's no longer available. It was fake, right? Mm-hmm. But the guy who sent it to me doesn't know it's fake, and I don't know who else he sent it to, who probably doesn't click on it to see if it's true. And that stuff still circulates. And that's the kind of campaigner Trump is and always was, and he gets by.
But then why do you dismiss or dislike the fact that Jimmy Kimmel or the late night comics are making comedy out of this? If we point to the absurdity of it and it makes us laugh, that gets it pushed out into the environment as well, right?
I think it minimizes the danger of that story and increases awareness of the story.
Would you ignore it? Would you ignore it then?
No.
Would you ignore it?
No, I would just continually denounce it.
Okay, but you don't think that the memes that demonstrate the absurdity of it are in fact denouncing it as well? It just seems to me like, what's the best way to communicate? Getting on a soapbox and telling people, you know, this is really dangerous is one way to do it. And another way is to come up with funny songs that incorporate that line of the former presidents in the debate, you know, songified. You probably know the one I'm talking about. And it's hilarious. And that gets shared a lot too.
I understand what you're saying, Marge. It's obviously awful, but it was already out there. It was already going to be and was widely known without people making fun of it. And making fun of it is a way of bringing it down to earth. His people are not happy that he is spending all his time on weird things like this. It's not helping him.
Well, if it was truly diffusing the story, the threats wouldn't be increasing. And now, you know, neo-Nazi groups are going down there to march. They're keeping the story alive. And this undercurrent of fear of people who are different. And in this case, Haitian Americans are black. The visual of it adds to the fear that Trump is trying to capitalize on by othering yet another group of people. And I feel like, you know, we have a tenet in crisis PR. We say, don't repeat the negative. You know, the old Nixon, I am not a crook. Did someone call you a crook? I look into that. You know, you don't repeat that negative. So even if you're making jokes about it, you're raising this question. Someone sees a funny meme about dogs driving a car out of Springfield. They're like, whoa, what's that about? And they go look it up.
Yeah, okay.
It draws attention to the course.
I know
story.
That, but I think then you are drawing the conclusion that the people that will look it up or find out about it are going to conclude that Haitians are doing that or they're criminal. And I think it's just as likely that people will conclude these people are weird. This is not a serious candidate. That I think the circulation of that does the Trump campaign more harm than good. You almost sound like it's actually serving their purposes, Marge.
Well, I think in certain constituencies it is. People want to, there's his supporters.
What do you think the net effect is? What's the net effect?
Well, so far the net effect has been to increase the danger in Springfield for Haitians.
I'm sorry, but I don't mean to minimize that, but you know what I'm asking politically.
I think the more there's talk about immigrants in a context of fear, the more it helps Trump.
And maybe laughing at it comes at the expense of those people, too, as though they are objects of humor, when in fact they're people who are being threatened. I get that, too. I'll have to think about that point you're making more, Marge, because it runs against my calculus on this for the last couple of weeks. But maybe we should pay more attention to it in the terms you just brought up.
You know, we're oriented to see clearly what Eric is saying about how out of control he is and what Kate is saying and what you're seeing. We see him as unstable. We see his lies as soon as he says them. But the people who will decide this election are low information voters. They don't have the perspective we have. They don't have the depth of information. So when they just get the top line about dangerous migrants in Springfield, they walk away and they don't read anymore.
And I don't know that that makes us smarter. I mean, I don't think we are bragging about ourselves here, but that's just a phenomenon that a lot of people do. A large enough percentage of the people wait until right before the election before they decide to really dive into and then, you know, make decisions about who they're going to vote for. That's why I think actually this vice presidential debate will be interesting. Whoever thought one of those would be on October 1st. And I don't think there's not going to be another presidential debate, right? Donald Trump doesn't want that, or his team doesn't want that. And
we'll see about that. We'll see if the polls are showing him struggling. How can he resist an audience of 70 million people?
Yeah.
I can see him changing his mind on that.
Well, it just seems to me like the way some of these new polls are coming out this week in the swing states, three of them particularly, show that however much Kamala Harris has gained since the debate, Kate said it's plateaued, and that seems to be the case now. Donald Trump is going to be very viable in Georgia and Arizona and North Carolina. He's got a better chance of winning those three states today, according to the polls, two big caveats, than Kamala Harris does. That's it for this week, guys. It's good to see you all. Thanks for letting me host again. And Eric, thank you for hosting while I was gone.
I'll let you host again next week, I think, John. But no promises after that.
Austin had to click out, but Marge Halperin and Kate Plies and Eric Zorn, thanks for being on the panel this week. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Okay, boys and girls.
Good show, folks. That was fun.
Right.
Thanks for finding my little op-ed.
I know. I felt like, ooh, I know somebody famous.
I missed it. I did manage to miss it. But, what day was it in, Marge?
It was sometimes over the weekend.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was
well done. I still think I disagree with you, but all the better.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.